I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to the Midday News Wrap. Never a dull moment in Washington. Michael Flynn was a Trump campaign advisor, and then, ever so briefly, he was national security advisor. He was also a foreign agent working on behalf of the government of Turkey. Now he's offering to meet with congressional investigators and the FBI, but Flynn wants immunity as part of the deal. Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh isn't immune to criticism for saying no to a bill to raise wages for low-income workers. In Annapolis, the House and Senate have sent 27 bills to Governor Larry Hogan so far. What can we expect in the waning days of the session? Plus, breaking up is hard to do. The Brits begin divorce proceedings with Europe. The Midday News Wrap starts right after these headlines. And welcome to the Midday News Wrap, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very, very happy that you're with us. On most Fridays, we do this news wrap. We try to make sense of the week that was. And oh, what a week this was. It was a week of unraveling and unveiling. The Trump administration unraveled Obama-era rules on internet privacy and the environment. The House Intelligence Committee, which is, or at least was, investigating Russian meddling in the U.S. election and possible Trump ties to Russia, unraveled itself, canceling its public hearings amid loud calls for committee chair Devin Nunes to recuse himself from the Russia investigation. The New York Times and The Washington Post reported that Nunes met secretly with two or possibly three White House officials and then briefed the president about information that he had not shared with his own committee. The Senate Intelligence Committee, which is investigating the same issues, picked up the slack in what is, at least for the moment, a much more bipartisan manner. It held its first hearing yesterday, which included dramatic testimony from a former FBI agent. In Baltimore, Mayor Catherine Pugh unveiled her first budget proposal, which calls for lowering taxes while spending more on schools and police. She also vetoed a bill that would have raised the minimum wage in the city to $15 an hour by the year 2022. Britain took its first formal steps to exit the European Union, and Scotland took another step towards exiting Britain. So there's plenty to talk about today, and we will do so with a terrific panel of three great journalists who join me here in Studio A. Frances Steed Sellers is a writer on the national staff of The Washington Post. She covered the 2016 presidential election for The Post, and she's currently a journalism fellow at Oxford University in the UK. She was a key member of the Post team that produced the best-selling biography, Trump Revealed. Welcome, Frances. Good to see you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
E.R. Shipp is here as well. She's associate professor and journalist in residence at Morgan State University's School of Global Journalism and Communication. She's a columnist for the Baltimore Sun and the winner in 1996 of the Pulitzer Prize for commentary when she was at the New York Daily News. She also worked as a reporter and editor at the New York Times and as the ombudsman at the Washington Post. Shipp, good to have you back. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Good morning.
And Andy Green is here as well. He's the editorial page editor for the Baltimore Sun. Mr. Green, always a pleasure.
Great to see you.
And a little known fact about Andy Green, 2014 Sochi Olympics, men's figure skating gold medalist. Yeah. He's just so humble.
I don't like to talk about
he's
it.
He's humble, yeah. So he keeps it out of the official bio.
It puts me too close to Putin. I don't like to talk about it.
That's right. Yet another Russian connection. Yeah. That's right. I just thought in the spirit of the week, we'd just start Absolutely. With a little fake news yeah. and then devolve into the real stuff. But let's start with L'Affaire Nunes, as we say when we get prissy here on public radio. Frances Sellers, there are several who have suggested that Congressman Nunes's midnight ride to the White House, where he met a few officials, perhaps has the fingerprints of Steve Bannon. And you've written about Mr. Bannon. You've covered him. You've written about Mr. Trump, obviously. But there are those who say that the two or three sort of low-level folks, they're in their early 30s, they're not particularly experienced, they would not have animated and instigated this on their own, that this came from somewhere higher up. This is speculation, but I mean, what do you make of that speculation?
I think we should be very careful about speculation at this point, but I think we do know a lot about how Bannon has influenced the first few weeks of Trump's administration. We can go back through. Bannon is a very secretive character, he seems, and yet we have hours and hours of tape-recorded Bannon available to us on SoundCloud every day. He was on Breitbart News Daily, and all these recordings are out there. And those of us who've spent some time looking back on them can see how Bannon prepared the way for Trump's early moves in this administration. And it's fascinating. He laid the way on issues from immigration to questions about sovereignty, one of his massive causes. And here, I think we don't know the truth yet of what's happening, and I'm sure we will learn more as things go on. But I do think we know very much that Bannon is a key influence on Trump and has very much shaped the first few weeks of his administration.
And Andy Green, Ezra Cohen, who's one of the people alleged mm-hmm. to be a source for Congressman Nunes, and we should make clear that the White House has refused to discuss who the people right. were that Mr. Nunes met with, as has Mr. Nunes. But he has recently survived an attempt of people to fire him.
Yes.
And he then went to Jared Kushner, Mr. Trump's son-in-law and a key advisor, and again to Stephen Bannon, who sits on the National Security mm-hmm. Council and is a close advisor to the president. And all of a sudden, that decision to get rid of him got reversed. People are pointing to that as a possible, you know, motivation for him helping out, it appears, Mr. Nunes.
You know, it could be. There's obviously more to the story here in terms of, you know, how this relatively low-level person happened to be looking through these documents to find this information. Was he directed to do this? Did he just take it upon himself to try to find some basis for the president's tweets about being wiretapped at Trump Towers? But, you know, it's certainly very clear that the White House at least initially found this, quote, revelation that Mr. Nunes had of this new information useful. You know, the president says this sort of vindicates me. Although, you know, even if you take it at face value, it really doesn't, because what, even if you just assume for the sake of argument that this is all totally true, what Nunes said, it did not tell us anything we didn't really already know. I mean, we already knew that people in Trump world were picked up in the context of talking to people who were being monitored, foreign nationals who are being monitored. That was the whole story of the Michael Flynn situation. We knew this was happening. This is not news. Does not prove that Trump Tower was wiretapped. You know, it's all this very strange theater of distraction going on. You know, you almost wonder what else is going on that they don't want us to be paying attention to, that they're coming up with something as absurd as this.
Of course, it takes our attention away from these key issues that both the House and Senate are supposedly investigating, which is the level of Russian involvement. What was mm-hmm. going on there? And we get caught up instead in these areas of speculation, and we really don't know the answers.
Right.
But once more, distraction takes over from looking at the key questions that are underlying, and they're, mm-hmm. they're taking over on the Hill.
Distracting people from the real questions. This distraction technique is one that folks pointed to throughout the campaign, even. I mean, there's nothing new about Mr. Trump's proclivity for throwing up shiny objects and hoping people like us follow them. But I wonder, I mean, we're now in day 71, I think, of the administration.
Who's counting?
Yeah, well, a lot of folks are counting. I find that kind of interesting, actually, because, I mean, everybody does a sort of first 100 days appraisal of every administration. But I can't remember an administration in which people were doing it by the day. And I think it probably has to do with some thinking that this isn't going to last, you know, that somehow
that's wishful thinking.
The possibility of impeachment or Mr. Trump leaving office is a real one. But that's, of course, you know, who knows?
That's just another distraction.
But I mean, I wonder, is the distraction technique, as it were, going to lose its efficacy if Mr. Trump keeps using it so frequently, if that's what it is?
Well, it definitely is a technique. I think we can agree on that. But it seems to me the distraction is one that is affecting media people, and perhaps it's affecting those on the Hill. It really doesn't seem to be affecting most people, most regular folks. A lot of people just tune out all of this mess because they think it's politics and it's nasty anyway. But those who really support the president it occurred to me when I saw him speak, I guess, before Congress, that his core supporters probably only see him in that kind of setting where he seems rather sensible. And they really aren't following all this day-to-day who said what, when, how kind of thing. So I think the key thing is for media not to let themselves be caught up. On a day-to-day basis, it's kind of cute and fun and sexy sometimes to follow along and to try to plot the course of this mystery that's unfolding. But we can't get so caught up in that that we aren't paying attention to more serious issues.
Yeah, I think looking back to yesterday's very unusual Senate hearing, in which we learned a little bit about from academics and cyber experts about what Russian tactics may have been, this notion of distraction, of course, plays very well into a potential Russian goal to make America look incompetent, to make it look as if one side can't talk to the other. We can't run an investigation without one side calling on the leader of the other side's investigation to be recused. And I think the Senate is trying to step back from that and perhaps model a more bipartisan approach. But in doing so, they've revealed how very much it's in Russia's interest to show that America can't run an investigation, can't run itself, and undermining America overseas.
Yeah, and Andy Green, Clinton Watts, who's now a senior fellow at the George Washington Center for Cyber and Homeland Security, this is a field he knows well, told Senator Rubio yesterday, in one of many extraordinary moments, that basically he, Senator Rubio, was the target of Russian interference. And he mentioned specifically that as a candidate, Mr. Trump was parroting and repeating things that this Russian organizations, I mean, yes. RT, the television station and whatnot, you know, were sort of making stuff up. And by merit of the fact that Mr. Trump was repeating it, it was giving it enormous credibility. Yes. I mean, that's an extraordinary claim.
And it is, of course, from that, one cannot necessarily extrapolate the idea that Trump was intentionally parroting the Russian line, since we also know that he was willing to say anything about anyone, like, you know, that Ted Cruz's dad was involved in the Kennedy assassination or whatever. He would.
And that source was the National Enquirer.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, he seems perfectly willing to pick up anything that suits his purposes at any time. But, you know, it is certainly an interesting coincidence, at the very least, given the ties of his team to the Putin administration.
One of the people who has yet to fall under a lot of scrutiny, it seems to me, but may be in for some more scrutiny coming up, is Vice President Pence. And the reason is, it seems to me, is that he, Shipp, was the putative head of the transition team. And when mistakes were made, like Michael Flynn, who served very briefly as a national security advisor, who evidently, through his lawyers, tried to inform the Trump transition team that he was working for the government of Turkey or working for an organization related to the government of Turkey as a foreign agent, it seems to me that almost anyone else in that position would not be, in the vetting process, would be precluded from serving on the national security, as the head of the National Security Council. Does Pence bear any of the blame on this? Or who does?
I know. This is what I was saying. Who does bear the blame? It comes down to who President Trump wants to listen to, ultimately. And he will then overlook any of these other weaknesses or missteps on their part. He's come to rely upon Pence, obviously, to help guide him through the governing process. So I think it comes back to the president and who he decides he needs to help him best at this stage. So we mentioned earlier that people are hoping that this administration goes away in a short period of time. But I keep reminding people that if for some reason President Trump is not able to serve his full term, then we get President Pence. And that's not a great thing to be wishing for if you don't like what you have now.
Yeah, no. But I think the business of people not being able to conceive of this administration going on so long is it's just so much It's a little bit like our brains can't appreciate the vastness of space. You know, that the there's just too much. It's hard to imagine this level of zaniness and activity for four whole years.
That's one way to put it.
Trump's zany approval levels are very, very low at the moment, but there are an awful lot of people who still saw what he was like during the campaign and still appreciate him. And I do worry about getting inside these bubbles where journalists, I mean, it's in fact why Trump is there. Journalists and other elites, as they've become known, speak to one another and forget about the large number of people who still support Trump and are still hoping for change, and people whose lives were in coal.
Yeah, the
he talks to them all the time. You know, yeah. He talks to them all the time. And there is a solid base of support for him among those people.
About 35%, which is unbelievably low, but it also tracks just about where he was through the entire campaign.
Right.
So
he's always had low.
He hasn't lost any. It doesn't seem he's lost large. Because everybody's saying, well, as soon as people understand that, you know, their health care is going to be a mess or that the coal jobs aren't coming back, people just keep waiting for, you know, this shoe to drop. But it hasn't started to drop yet. We are going to take a little break. E.R. Shipp is a Pulitzer Prize winning columnist and journalist in residence at Morgan's School of Global Journalism and Communication. You can read her in the Baltimore Sun. Andy Green is the editorial page editor for the aforementioned Baltimore Sun. And Frances Steed Sellers covered the 2016 presidential election as a writer on the national staff of the Washington Post. She's currently a journalism fellow at Oxford University, and we've caught her on a rare trip back to Baltimore today. We'll have more of the Midday News Wrap, and we'll take your calls and comments right after this break. 410-662-8780 is our phone number, our email midday at WIPR.org. If you want to drop us a tweet, our handle is at midday Tom Hall. Stick around. We will be right back.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back, everybody. Glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall. It's the Midday News Wrap. By the way, coming up Monday, it's Midday on Sports. I'll be joined by Mike Pesca of Slate.com and NPR, as well as our good friend Milton Kent, whose commentary we enjoy every week here on WYPR. Monday is opening day for the O's. It's the championship game in the NCAA men's basketball tournament. It's the beginning of Masters Week in Augusta, Georgia. So there's plenty to talk about in the world of sports, and we hope you can join us Monday on Midday. Joining me today for the Midday News Wrap, Andy Green. He's the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun. Frances Steed Sellers is on the national staff of the Washington Post. She's currently a journalism fellow at Oxford University. We should make sure that folks know that that's in the UK, not the one in Georgia, although the one
in Georgia
is a fine institution.
I'm guessing there's less rain in Georgia.
Yeah, my brother graduated from Oxford University in Georgia, as a matter of fact, and E.R. Shipp. She's here as well. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner, a columnist for the Baltimore Sun, an associate professor and journalist in residence at Morgan State's School of Journalism. You are welcome to join our conversation. We're talking Trump. We're talking a little bit later about Governor Hogan and Catherine Pugh, the mayor of Baltimore, talking about stuff in the news this week. 410-662-8780 is our number, our email midday at WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle at midday Tom Hall. So Mr. Flynn has Mike Flynn, the former national security advisor, albeit a brief tenure in that position, has told Senate and congressional investigators as well as the FBI that he's willing to talk to them. But he's also said that he wants immunity before he does that. It turns out that immunity was on the minds of Mr. Trump and Mr. Flynn and others in the Trump campaign during the election campaign. Here's what Mr. Trump had to say about the fact that Hillary Clinton's team, five members of Hillary Clinton's team, had been granted immunity to talk to investigators about the email server.
Then her aides took the Fifth Amendment and her ringleaders were given immunity. And if you're not guilty of a crime, what do you need immunity for?
Then Mr. Trump on Twitter, I guess yesterday, said Mike Flynn should ask for immunity and that this is a witch hunt, excuse for big election loss by media and Dems of historic proportion with the signature exclamation point at the end of that tweet. Mr. Flynn appeared on Meet the Press. He also had a couple things to say about immunity as well.
When you are given immunity, that means that you've probably committed a crime.
So that's pretty blatant there. I mean, it doesn't leave a whole lot of room to wiggle on that.
They use quotation marks around those words.
I guess. I mean, but we do all have to be careful to understand that people who request immunity are not always doing it because they feel they have guilt that will be revealed. I mean, Ship, what should we, if anything, read into this immunity issue? And this is yet another one of these distractions we've been talking about so far.
Well, we shouldn't read a lot into it yet. In our legal system, it's kind of routine in certain investigatory matters for people who could themselves become subjects of investigations to seek some kind of protection. So we're at a very early stage in this congressional investigation, and it's not unusual for someone to seek this. But it's kind of muddied right now as to whether he has indeed sought immunity, whether it's being contemplated, whether it's been turned down. We just know the word is out there that something is going on. But I wouldn't read too much into it at this stage.
Yeah, at this point, we don't have an answer.
We don't have an answer.
We don't have an answer as to whether or not the immunity will be accepted.
Yeah. Right, or even whether it's been formally requested. And I think that's a status that Flynn's attorney would ask for. He'd ask for, I think it's called Queen for a Day status, where he would deal off the record with what story Flynn has and then make a deal about it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first line of the statement by Robert Kellner, who is representing General Flynn, says, "General Flynn certainly has a story,
to tell,
and he very much wants to tell it should circumstances permit." I mean,
is he angling for a book deal or congressional testimony?
Or is he worried about the fact that he was pretty casual about registering as a foreign agent working on behalf of the government of Turkey?
Well, he may be. And the other thing to bear in mind is, what he may say or want to say or in a congressional investigation may be very different from what he would want to say in his defense if it ever came to a trial. So that's something to bear in mind, too, for a reason why he would request immunity in this context, just to separate these two processes. That kind of thing happens all the time.
Yeah, and there are a bunch of folks saying this is just an example of very good lawyering.
Right. Mm-hmm. And also, I think it's worth looking at this language that Trump used, a witch hunt. Again, it gets us back into this notion that Russia must love, right, of America being unable to move forward with an investigation, move forward with what's going on. We've had the term McCarthyism thrown around as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It allows the president to try to frame the discussion somewhat. So if he's now calling it a witch hunt, that's a signal to his supporters, number one, to not give any credibility to what's going on with Congress and to put Congress on the defensive, perhaps, as they're looking into these subjects.
410-662-8780. 410-662-8780. That's our number here on Midday. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. It's the News Wrap with E.R. Shipp, Andy Green, and Francis Sellers from The Washington Post. This notion of credibility, Andy, I mean, you deal with this in your newsroom, Francis, you in your newsroom, and Shipp, you in your classroom. Every day. David Fahrenthold, who's done incredible reporting for The Washington Post about following up on Trump's promises to donate things to charity.
Right.
And has exposed, without question, any number of instances in which Trump made charitable promises that he's not delivered on. One of the promises he made to Leslie Stahl at 60 Minutes before he was inaugurated that he wasn't going to take a salary as president of the United States. It pays $400,000 a year. To date, the president has received and accepted $66,000 of salary and has not made any indication of who he may give this money to. He talked about donating it to charity, perhaps giving it back to the Treasury. I'm not even sure how you do that.
I'm sure they'll take
write a check,
check
to IRS or something.
I imagine they'll take it if you want to give it to him.
But
if you want to try.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem that he's doing that. I mean, Sean Spicer kind of in a jocular way, suggested to the White House press corps that they come up with suggestions for charities that should receive mm-hmm. Mr. Trump's alleged largesse. You just got to wonder, I mean, when he speaks, can we believe anything that this gentleman is saying?
Well, I think from his perspective, he has up to this point suffered no ill consequences from saying things and not following through on them. He is not, you know, he said all sorts of things during the campaign that he did not do or, you know, did not intend to do. You know, he never released his taxes, never did any number of things. He suffered no ill consequences for it. And so from his perspective, I'm sure, why worry about it?
I'd just like to add a little bit. You mentioned David's name, and I've worked with David several times recently and in the past. And I think one of the great lessons that came out of reporting last year was the way he managed to use social media and report in a very open way to increase transparency of the press. So he, you know, we've all used social media to promote our stories, to make sure they reach other people. David used Twitter to do his reporting, to ask people what was going on. And it's a total change for investigative journalism, which used to be a rather secretive process. Mm-hmm. David's done it out in the open and got great results from it. And people can watch it happening in real time. And that's a remarkable change and a very necessary one in this era. And when many people doubt truth, doubt the news, doubt what's going on. And this was all done.
And it's, of course, played very important role in the citizen journalism having to do with police misconduct, police brutality across
very
the country.
Much so.
Yeah,
very much
here
so.
In Baltimore and a lot
but,
of other places.
But on the notion, too, of the president's and credibility, one wonders at what point people will begin to trust their own eyes. When you remember, one of the things he said was that he would not be playing golf. He would not be taking a day off. It was serious business. He was going to be working. Mm-hmm. And it's gotten to the point that every weekend he's at his golf clubs. And so Spicer's trying to explain that he's not really playing golf. He's negotiating all kinds of national business when he's doing that. But Fox declared it was news that he was working last weekend at the White House when he wasn't. But the whole notion is no one's holding him accountable. And he can still say, as he did to Time magazine, well, I'm just being me, and I'm president, you're not. That's his attitude. He doesn't care.
Mm-hmm. One of the Apprentice contestants I interviewed some time ago said of Trump, you know, he's a flawed human being. And then the same person said, you know, Hillary Clinton is a flawed politician, and people dislike flawed politicians when they're trying to be politicians more than they dislike flawed human beings. And I thought it was very insightful. And they have forgiven him and see in themselves the kind of daily transgressions where you don't live up to the promises you've made, where you step back from.
I mean, we have grown accustomed to that level of insight from reality television contestants.
Yeah.
You know, Shipp, you wrote a column last week in which you used the phrase, you talk about Harriet Tubman and what the lessons mm-hmm. we could learn from Harriet Tubman. And you use the phrase diabolical plan to destroy the country in relation to Mr. Trump. And that's an interesting thing, because I suppose there are folks who think that. There's also folks who think that this is just sort of a bumbling exercise in supreme incompetence. But, I mean, do you think that there is a sort of malice behind this, and that it's systematic and purposeful?
It may be more bumbling on the part of the president, but he's listening to people who I think do have some plans in mind, like Mr. Bannon. So I don't think, I think Bannon and company have some worldview in which the things we're seeing play into that. So it's dismantling Obama policies on one hand, but it's setting us up for a different world order. And I think that's what I mean when I say there's some diabolical undermining going on.
410-662-8780 is how you can join us here on the Midday News Wrap. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Andy Green, let's shift and pivot to Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh. Mm-hmm. A couple big things in the news with her this week. She unveiled her first budget, and she also made a very controversial decision to veto the bill that the city council passed, which would have raised the minimum wage here in the city to $15 an hour by the year 2022. What do you think the fallout of that decision is?
It'll be interesting to see. She did during the campaign support the idea of a $15 minimum wage. She also did say at the time that she thought it was something better handled on the state level. She bought herself a lot of goodwill from the business community by doing this and angered unions, some church groups, activists in the city. So, you know, it was a difficult balance for her to strike. The question, I think she can certainly win people back if she uses that capital that she has bought herself from the Greater Baltimore Committee and the big employers in town to try to seriously do something around the issues of the working poor in this city. She's talked about some plans she has in that regard. She has, you know, these mobile employment centers she's trying to roll out. But I think if she can really get the corporate community behind supporting some very meaningful things in that regard, then she can maybe play this to an advantage. But, you know, I think from her perspective, there are a few things playing into it. You know, one, it would have cost the city, depending on whom you ask, you know, the finance department said like $155 million over 4 years in terms of higher wages that the city is paying alone. And at a time when there are a lot of demands on the city budget, you know, I think that swayed her somewhat. And then also, you know, there is some momentum in the city in terms of employment picking back up in the last couple of years. I think she definitely doesn't want to hinder that. You know, the other thing that was interesting about this from a purely political standpoint is when the minimum wage bill passed the city council, it passed with enough supporters to override a mayoral veto. You needed 12 votes. It got 11 votes when it was passed, and one guy, Brandon Scott, was out of town, and he was a yes vote. So you had your 12. Under the old city council, in the old days, quite routinely, they would pass things with veto-proof margins. The mayor, whoever it was at the time, would veto them, and then the council would back down. The new young guns on the council don't play that way.
And there are eight of them, yeah. Eight out of 14. Right. Yeah, 15 if you count Council President Jack.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was not surprising to see that the guy who switched his vote to say, I voted for it, but I'm not going to override the veto, was Ed Reisinger, an old guard guy. You know, previously it would have been Bobby Curran who caved. You know, he would have been the guy who said, well, if the mayor says it, you know, I'll do this. But it's clear that the new young guns on the council aren't interested in playing by those old kind of rules. And it's going to be interesting to see that dynamic play out and what other ways they challenge the mayor, what other ways they challenge the city council president as time goes on. That could be very interesting to watch.
And Chip, the timing of this is striking in that we are just a few days short of the month anniversary of the uprising that followed the death of Freddie Gray, which is the 27th of April coming up next month. And at that time, there was all this talk about the investment that's needed in communities of color on the West Side, on the East Side, all this talk of job training, job opportunities, living wage, education. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake announced with great fanfare the creation of this thing called One Baltimore, headed by a very respected businessman, Michael Cryer. They raised something around in the order of $800,000 or $900,000. They opened an office, they hired a staff, and then we learn about 10 days ago, they're out of business.
Out of business.
Nothing happened.
Right.
I mean, it just seems like there was all this flurry where there were panels and discussions and art made about it. And then 2 years later,
yes,
nothing.
Some would even argue that a lot of that was meant to be kind of a distraction, too, to kind of deflate all the activity that was going on then in the streets to make people think that something was really going to change. Now, Mr. Cryer said he had received pledges of more than $20 million at one point, I believe, but the corporations never came through. So it was, you know, the paltry figure that you just cited.
But still, that's a paltry $900,000 that was taken out of the philanthropic
yes, it
pool.
Was.
You know, I mean, that money could have gone to somebody.
Well, and I would argue that the issue at heart was that there was no real strong mayoral leadership behind this.
That's very true. And there was a lot of people.
From Mrs. Rawlings Blake.
You're talking. Yes.
Yeah.
There were people in the communities who were having lots of meetings thinking that they were in line to receive some grants to help them with programs that they had in mind, to provide job training, to work with young people in the summer and beyond. And no one could ever figure out how to tap into that source of money. And nor could Mr. Cryer from the One Baltimore offices figure out who the people were who needed to receive this aid. So I think it was largely it's coming down to a public relations ploy that never really had a sense of how to connect the dollars and the people who could put into play these programs.
I'm curious as well about the role people here in Baltimore feel about the Trump administration, which of course has said they wanted, you know, we want to do something about you know, underprivileged parts of cities that need help.
I believe we are all, every one of us, holding our breaths.
Holding our breath, yeah.
We'll talk about that. John Fritzi in The Sun had a piece that was posted last night about that very thing. We'll see where that goes because it's all taken up in the healthcare stuff because, you know, the strategy to start with healthcare instead of stuff like infrastructure.
And infrastructure, this is education, that, policing, all
these
issues.
All that. So we'll take that up when we come back. Frances Steed Sellers covered the 2000 election for The Washington Post. She's a journalism fellow in the UK at Oxford University. E.R. Shipp is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for commentary. She's now a professor and journalist in residence at Morgan State and a columnist for the Baltimore Sun. Andy Green edits the editorial page at the Baltimore Sun. By the way, before we go to a break, a news item from the world of philanthropy in Baltimore City. Speaking of folks giving money away, Tom Wilcox announced earlier this week that he will be stepping down later this year as the head of the Baltimore Community Foundation. A search for his successor is underway. The Community Foundation is another one of those organizations that includes many private foundations and philanthropic organizations, and they try to allocate resources to groups and individuals who are working to improve things for people in the city along with other charitable pursuits. So best of luck to Tom Wilcox. The Community Foundation is something that folks look to when things like One Baltimore went bye-bye. So I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break, we'll continue with the Midday News Wrap. 410-662-8780 is our number, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Stick around.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. E.R. Shipp joins us. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and a professor and journalist in residence at Morgan State. Andy Green is the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun, and Frances Steed Sellers covered the 2016 election for the Washington Post. She's now a journalism fellow over in England at Oxford University. You are welcome to join us at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So, Frances Sellers, before I run out of time, I want to ask you, because you were in Britain when Prime Minister Theresa May made this first foray into the process of exiting from the European Union. What's the mood? We know to some extent what the mood on the ground.
Huge uncertainty, I think, is the mood.
But the ground here, the mood on the ground in America since the election has been quite unsettled by on a lot of people. But what's it like already?
I think it's very similar. I mean, over there, an awful lot of people don't know what to expect. Both Leavers and Remainers are uncertain about what the future holds. I think the Leavers are far more optimistic. Of course, the day after the vote, many people sort of said the world's going to come to an end. And in fact, the world hasn't come to an end. The negotiations promised to be so complicated that I think nobody is certain where they will lead. And uncertainty isn't great for business, of course. So I think you're going to see less investment coming up. But this week was fascinating because Theresa May made this very theatrical, sent her letter, made her this theatrical signing of it. And 2 days later, Donald Tusk, of course, responded by saying, the European Union is going to set the timetable and set the terms of this negotiation. They're certainly not going to let Britain go with a nice, cozy deal for Britain because they don't want the rest of the EU to break up. So I think reality is beginning to hit, but it will still be slow because French and German elections are coming up. Germany, not until September. And true negotiations can't really happen until those elections have been settled and we know what the future of the rest of the European Union is. So, boy, uncertainty is the name of the game over there.
And with candidates like Marine Le Pen in France,
yep,
you know, getting great sustenance and succor from the notion
right,
that,
you know, not
the
leading
union
in the polls right now. Mm-hmm. We'll see. I mean, I think there's a question of whether the perceived disarray in this country is slowing down what we had wondered whether was a, you know, wave of populism crossing Europe. So in the Netherlands, for example, the populist candidate, the anti-immigration candidate, didn't win. Marine Le Pen has been up and down in the polls. She's not leading right now. Germany seems to be stepping back from the most populist move that could come. But we don't know, and we've been surprised twice in the past year. Polls didn't hold up. We'll wait and see.
And Andy Green, getting back to this tension often, or this relation, this, you know, interconnectivity between cities and their federal you know, jurisdictions and then the federal establishment. Here's Mayor Pugh talking to the congressional delegation, according to John Fritzi, who had a nice piece about it in The Sun that was posted last night, saying that they're going to the city of Baltimore is going to be going to the federal government for infrastructure,
yes,
for housing, for education. Mm. These are things that, you know, Mr. Trump did, as Francis and Chip have mentioned, you know, make hay about during the campaign. But given the fact that he had this debacle with health care, he was not able to get that even close to the finish line. And folks now saying, well, he should have started with infrastructure because that's something everybody likes, except for a big contingent of conservative Republicans who don't like to spend money on anything. What are Senator Pugh's, or Mayor Pugh's, I gotta get that. I'm still not used to it. The election, you know, she took office in December. I'm just a slow learner. But Mayor Pugh's relationship with Governor Hogan, and what do you think? Is there a relationship with the Trump administration?
Well, she certainly got a catch more flies with honey than vinegar attitude about these sorts of things. You know, you'll recall after she was Mr. Trump was here for the Army-Navy game, she tracked him down. She handed him a very nice letter. And you just think about what this letter would have been like if Stephanie Rawlings Blake, who was sort of prominent in Democratic politics nationally, she would not, I think, have taken quite so straightforward an approach as Mayor Pugh did. And certainly we saw that Mayor Pugh's relationship with Governor Hogan has worked out pretty well in terms of trying to get some additional funding for the Baltimore City Schools. So it worked on that front. How much juice Governor Hogan has with the Trump administration is another question altogether. He, of course, did not endorse Donald Trump. He says he wrote in his father's name on the ballot. So I don't know how far he's going to get, or, you know, whether this infrastructure thing is ever going to happen. I mean, if Mr. Trump really does follow through with trying to do that, the answer to that question may have more to do with how this current spat with the Freedom Caucus plays out. If Trump really does try to make common cause with Democrats and say, forget you guys, you know, that could happen. I mean, Democrats have been talking about doing an infrastructure bill forever.
Yeah,
but Trump started as the Democrat.
Yeah, well, that's true, too.
Well, he switched his party affiliations four or five times.
He's believed in single payer healthcare in the past.
In the best of all worlds, the mayor could count on someone like a Ben Carson as an advocate. He's in the administration. He's from Baltimore.
Or head of housing and urban development.
Which
but that's been gutted.
He was evidently born for.
Well, yeah, right.
Who knew?
He already said he's not qualified for any of these jobs, and he has one. But one of the first actions taken by President Trump was essentially to gut a number of the programs that would have benefited cities. So we don't know how much of an advocate we can count on in Mr. Carson.
And Andy Green, before we go to some emails and a phone call, give us an update on the city schools. Is this now crisis averted, problem solved?
Maybe not entirely. They've solved a lot of the problem. We're
the problem
still,
originally was put out as a $130 million deficit.
And so the point was that not that they spent $130 million that they didn't have. This is projecting to say, look, next year, here are our expenses. Here's what we're expecting from revenue. And there was a shortfall of $130 million for a variety of reasons. They have solved most of that through promises of additional funding from the city, from the state, and from some administrative reductions that the new CEO, Sonia Santelices, has found that will not affect classroom learning. But there still is a pretty big hunk, I think around $40 million of cuts that will still affect the schools. And so we're waiting to see exactly how that's going to play out. The principals had been given sort of the austerity budgets for their schools, and we're going through and making plans based on that. And then more recently, Ms. Santelices has said, okay, it's looking like we're going to get some money back. Tell me what you would put back in. So for all the parents out there and all the students wondering what this is going to mean, we still don't know yet. It's not going to be as bad as we originally thought, but there's still going to be some pain ahead, I think.
Yeah, you're seeing $42 million or $40 million as a potential gap that still needs to be made up. Last year, the city spent $42 million, according to some estimates, on police overtime.
Yes.
And the mayor has suggested shifting some of the money from the police department to the schools. Mm-hmm. That certainly has a symbolic weight, perhaps. So we'll just have to see how that goes. Here's an email from a person who wants to remain anonymous. Says, has anyone considered whether or not Nunez, so he's back to Devin Nunez, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, has anybody considered whether or not Nunez, in fact, was himself tapped in phone conversations as a member of the Trump Committee for the Election and Transition, and was that part of the information that he became privy to, and also that Bannon and the White House decided it was a perfect way to contaminate the investigation by letting him see that, essentially creating a mistrial? I mean, for all of what's going on there, if in fact Bannon, if in fact Bannon's aspiration is to shut down the House Intel, he's
right.
done that.
He's done.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, hasn't well, he? I mean, right. they're not meeting anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, hasn't he done that? Here's Sue, who writes in, I do remember while Mr. Trump was campaigning that he said, if I don't win, I know this campaign is rigged, leading me to believe that he has had already set up the win. So I truly want to support Mr. Trump. I want to move forward for the good of all, but he gives me nothing to work with. Every day is disturbing. Let's go to the phones. James in Baltimore, welcome to the Midday News Wrap.
Thank you for having me, Tom. I served 22 years in the military and over 21 years in Saudi, and I told my family and friends that I'll vote for Hillary, but I hope Donald gets in because it's going to be fun, and he hasn't disappointed me one bit.
So you think this has been fun, James, huh?
Yeah, interesting. Well, he's not even finished 100 days yet.
No, he has not. I mean, Francis Sellers, the urge to disrupt was clearly quite, quite significant. And disrupt he has done.
He has absolutely disrupted. And I don't know that as many people as our caller would call it fun as a result.
Yes.
I think there are people who care about schools and other things who are
perhaps this
hoping
is sort
for
of
some
the,
answers here.
The NASCAR presidency. You don't go to see cars drive in circles. You go to see the crash.
Yeah, well, you know, but of course it's also difficult to avert your eyes, too, mm-hmm. while the crashes are happening. I mean, that happened during the campaign with every, you know, with the Billy Bush video. People were glued to it, and it didn't seem to matter one lick.
I mean, because people were, I guess, being entertained by some of this, didn't really take Trump seriously. A lot of people never thought he would have gotten this far. So I think it took a while for people to start realizing, maybe we should pay attention. Maybe we should stop laughing and pay some attention. Maybe it was a little too late at that point.
All right. Well, James, thank you for your service and thank you for your call. And thanks to our panel. I appreciate everybody coming by today on a rainy day. I'm very much grateful to you. And we will check in with you again sometime soon. Appreciate
it. Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Andy Green, he's the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun. Frances Steed Sellers is on the national staff of the Washington Post. She's currently a journalism fellow at Oxford University in the UK. E.R. Shipp is a professor and journalist in residence at Morgan State University's Journalism School. She won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary, and she is a columnist for the Baltimore Sun. Monday is opening day for the Orioles. There are new rules in the NFL, and by then the NCAA Final Four will be whittled down to the final two. Mike Pesca from Slate.com and NPR will be with me along with Milton Kent of Sports at Large. That's coming up Monday on midday, and I hope you can join us. Lunch for our guests today is provided by Two Boots Pizza. They're on the West Mount Royal Avenue near Micah. We feed you lunch when you come over here. You're welcome to it. So they're on over on West Mount Royal near Micah, UB, and Central Baltimore. Two Boots offers creative and traditional New York pizzas with a New Orleans twist for on-site dining, catering, and for delivering. You can reach them online at twoboots.com. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. The show is produced by Rob Sivek, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coghlan from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Charlie Hines provides production assistance. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. Enjoy Light City. It opens tonight. And have a great weekend.